accession number 18523, reel 5.
Edwinkler reel 5.
And from there we went to Roos near Whittonsey, East Yorkshire, where by then had been become enough proficient in the English language to be classified as an interpreter. And I used to tell the various people the various jobs they had to do at the farms, went out with the lorry, and then came back to camp, and I used to go to Whittonsey, walk to Whittonsey, which was only about a couple of miles, 3 miles, I think. And I met various people there.
I think this is where you met your first wife, was it not?
Yes, that's where I met my first wife.
How did you come to meet her?
Oh, she was coming up to me and handed me a packet of cigarettes. You know, she was... her brother had been a Royal Commando, paratrooper. And I got friendly with those people. At the same time, there used to be, in Whittonsey, there used to be a picture house manager, Reginald Tomes. He was a member of the International Alliance. And the first time I got into Whittonsey, he invited me to his house for tea and whatever. And afterwards, he used to keep a raincoat in the foyer of his cinema, which I used to put on to go and see the pictures.
You were telling me that prisoners of war weren't allowed to go into Hull.
Prisoners of war, they're not allowed to go into Hull due to the fact that it was a port that was shipping, and there was foreign ships, so the chance would of a German prisoner possibly escaping, even then.
Were any of the prisoners trying to escape once you got to England?
Not to England, no. We had in North Yorkshire, we had a contact with an Irishman who wanted us to go over to Ireland, but we were saying, well, the war is finished, what do we want to go to Ireland for? You know, we can't go back to Germany, it's occupied, so it was pretty useless. We didn't take any notice of that.
Why did he want you to go to Ireland?
I don't know. This is one of the puzzles that I never found a reason for.
Were the POWs in England contented or discontented?
They were contented, yes. We had quite a lot of liberties. We could go out of the camp. We could walk into, you know, the underlying villages and everything like that. We had no restrictions except, of course, the port of Hull, which was understandable. So this is in Roos, so, and then Roos, by then I was repairing clocks, grandfather clocks, which the farmers brought down on the horse and carts, and I used to hire a barracks of the sergeant in charge at £5 a week, and had quite a good income in those days. Now, from Roos, we went to Fort Godwin, that's Killensey, the fortification that was a battery. In the battery, there was a compound for German prisoners.
Fort Godwin?
Fort Godwin, as they called it. It's, I don't know, have you been to that area? Do you know when you go to Killensey, you get towards the beach again, and then the road turns at right angles to Spurn Point. That is, at the corner there is a Bluebell Inn, it was at that time. and the camp was just on the side of that one. And we were employed in producing coastal defence, which was due to the tides, and we used to come by. I've got special mixtures of cement and sand and something else added to it. And those blocks used to be piled up together, and then the tide came over, used to solidify them. And this is where another rather interesting incident occurred. The habitat was in the morning when we went down there. According to the times, they used to go, the German prisoners used to strip up and go into the sea, have a dive first, and then start work. And I was coming up and towards the beach, and I saw a couple of girls with field glasses in one of the dunes down there. So I went round to the beach and I said, "Now, fellas, don't look round now, but behind me, about 50 yards, there's a couple of girls watching us with field glasses. When I give the command, charge." I've never seen anybody run as fast as those two girls. It's the happier times you remember as a prisoner of war. Yeah, and from there we went to...
This sounds as though it's 1947 by the sound of it.
Yes, yes.
And you were making coastal defences?
Sea defence.
Sea defences, yes.
Sea defences, not defences, sea defences. There was a bit of a railway to Spurn Point there, and I don't know whether they wanted to protect that or something like it. But I remember when I was there, we were taking down the barbed wire and taking it halfway up Spurn Point and dumping it. I was driving a dumper truck then. Quite an experience. And that's where we had a South African coming to inspect the camp, a high-ranking officer. And he got me aside and he says, "I want you to teach all those people here English." You know, I was an interpreter for him then. And he says, "Do you know why?" I said, "Well, it's that they can understand the orders." He says, no. "We don't want that schlamassel again we had with the last war. If you cannot talk to people in the language, you can explain things to them, and the people will find out you're just the same people." You know, that was rather a point.
He was a soldier?
He was a high-ranking officer. For some reason, he came into the camp and inspected the camp. But he was a South African, you know, by birth or by regiment, whatever. That's what I... And I don't know, but he used the Jewish word, you know, schlamassel.
What does it mean?
A mess, you know.
Did you teach him English?
I, of course, yes, I made sort of groups. By the way, the one thing that I haven't mentioned before, while I was in Jabbika, I had an American book. It was called The Painted Lady. I couldn't speak much English then, but it was something, a story about a sailship. And it was one of those that opened long ways, American publications, and I must have read it in that camp about 15 times. At the 15th time, I began to understand what the story was about. So I learned a lot, sort of self-taught English. And of course, the other thing was any opportunity I got to listen to English people talking, you know, to get the melody of it or the tone of it. And it all helped to... The other thing, I got hold of a dictionary, and I had to find out what every word meant. I still do. It came quite handy later on, because I think my knowledge of English language is quite extensive. Anyhow.
So you're at Killinsea at Fort Godwin.
Yeah. Doing the coastal defence. And from there we went to Rye Hill.
Is this in the East Riding?
This is again here, not far from Hatton. Rye Hill.
Yes. What happened at Rye Hill?
Rye Hill again was an agricultural work area. We were in a camp there. There's still some of the. There's a mess hall is still standing there now.
Actually, it says on your list that you went to Rye Hill before Kilnsay, but
that
doesn't particularly matter.
No.
And you also went to Middleton on the Wolds.
Middleton on the Wolds, yes. That was a camp at the crossroads in Middleton, in an agricultural depot. There was a small camp in the back of it. We were there, and again, working on farms and me acting as interpreter.
Did you as a POW ever get any kind of political indoctrination I've heard that German POWs were expected to change their political opinions.
Well, I think there must have been something, especially in the first camp. But by then we weren't totally convinced that the war was lost. I mean, we knew that the war was lost, but we weren't totally convinced, and we said, oh, it's enemy propaganda. I remember when this story about Buchenwald and Belsen came up, we didn't believe a word of it, because we had been totally separated from that. We had no idea that there was, well, we knew there was concentration camps as such, because one of my neighbours, he was an organiser of the Communist Party. Well, he disappeared in the camp and came back rather subdued, you know. So, but any sort of indoctrination, there was not that I know of, not that I remember.
And after Middleton on the Wolds?
After Middleton, it was... No, I'm not sure. I think it was Selby.
Yes, so according to your list.
Yes, Selby.
This is November 1947.
Yeah.
What happened at Selby?
Well, again, agricultural work. Being ferried out to the various farms and doing jobs.
And then I think your last one, you put Skipton. Yes, in West Riding.
In Skipton, we were working in a quarry. There was a sort of rock quarry. It was on the way towards North Yorkshire. If you are in Skipton, the castle, that road that goes towards North Yorkshire, it was on there. And again, there we had a interesting little sideline. There was a boundary wall around the quarry to keep kids out and things like that. And a part had fallen down, and the chappie there said, is there any bricklayers among you? So the German bricklayers built up the wall again. And the wall was promptly knocked down again by the Union people that wanted the job. It's just one of the sidelights again. And the other thing was that if we had a certain quota, we used to get a pork pie.
And now I think we're in 1948, the early part of 1948, according to your list on your mess tin.
Yeah, that's... we were still at Skipton there when that heavy winter was there, and we were supposed to... I think it was one of the major roads at North Hallerton. We were supposed to dig that. But the snow was at least 30 metres deep. So what we did there, dug holes and played cars. There was no chance of getting anything. It was very, very deep indeed. As soon as you moved something, it was filled in again.
I And was it at Skipton that you ceased to be a POW?
No, no. I went then from there to, what was it, Droitwich.
That's in Worcestershire?
Yeah. There was another one. Worcester and Droitwich, yes. Again, agricultural work. And from there we went to Teddington Hall in, not far from Staffordshire, what they call it. Can you read?
No, I can't read it, actually.
Tettersley Hall. It was a camp, a British Army camp, and we were there.
So when did you come to be released then? Because this is now 1948,
yes.
And you're still a prisoner.
Yes, I'm still a prisoner, yes. Actually, I think I've got the prisoner release paper. It's 31st of December I got released from prisoner of war status.
31st of December 1948?
Yes.
Why were you kept as a prisoner so long?
The reason we were given that they were keeping the SS and paratroopers, you know, as long as possible to prevent any uprising in Germany. That was the story we were told.
Do you think there was any possibility of an uprising in Germany?
Well, there was quite some bits and pieces going on in Germany. Sort of, there were various small groups of people doing murders, English soldiers, and which I'm not sure. I wasn't there, so I can't say. But I know from newspaper reports at the time that things like that were going on in Germany.
So,
and actually, this camp at Tettersley Hall was a sort of repatriation camp. But by then, with the correspondence I had with Germany, there was nothing for me. My mother was living in a very small room in somebody else's flat. And I intended to learn a bit more English to be able to use English later on in Germany. And there was a quota of so and so many ex-POWs to remain in England. And when I applied to the job, the officer in charge says, "I'm afraid the list is full." You know, and by then, having had quite a lot of contacts with watchmakers, etc., at a gold whistle watch, I said, "Would this change the situation?" And I remained in England. And then from there, we got a month's leave in Germany and came back to Rugeley near Stafford. And that was then a camp where we worked as civilians.
Doing what?
Farm work. For a time, I was looking after the camp itself. I did the vegetable garden and such like. And then I lived in on a farm at Little Haywood, Navigation Farm, they called it. It's on the side of a canal. And I was living in there and working on there. And meanwhile, I was still corresponding with the girl in Whittlesey. And I think after a while, I made an appointment to come back to East Riding of Yorkshire. And I was living in a farm at Hulsham and worked on various farms. Neville's farm was one of them at Hompton. And I was working on a farm in at the corner towards Whittlesey. He used to supply the milk to the town of Whittlesey. And at night I used to go to a local engineering firm and do a little bit of tool making, and it was Seasawn Steel Constructors, they called themselves, and the manager there got in touch with the representative at that time, was called Richard Wood, and questions were raised in the House of Parliament, and I was one of the first ex-POWs to work in industry in this country, and I worked for that firm. And of course I had to learn the imperial system.
You mean until Richard Wood raised the question in Parliament, German ex-POWs
were not allowed in industry. But this boss at Seeson said, well, we need tool makers, and I was by then making tools for Blackburn Aircraft, milling fixtures and jigs and that's right. And he got me free. You know, the chappie from the labour exchange came down while I was ploughing a field, and he told me that I was released from the agriculture status.
And did you get married then to your girlfriend?
No, it was a bit later on, because I worked there, and I remember he made me foreman after a while, and I got a penny an hour extra over the wages of the rest of them. And I had an argument with him over a holiday or something at one time, and I went to Hull and applied for a job at Priestman Brothers, and I went to the firm there, and I worked 13 years for Priestman's, in the end as a planning engineer. I used to do that many suggestions that most of the months got the first prize of £25, which was quite a bit of money in those days. In the end, Mr. Philip Priestman came down to me and says, what the hell are you doing on the shop floor? You're telling our engineers how to do the job. So I got a job in the office. It was 13 years. But before I went into the office itself, I was working on the shop floor on a horizontal boring machine, and was working night shifts. And that's when my first wife got herself a boyfriend. And the thing didn't come onto daylight until the time I was getting the German engineering magazines, the sort of public ones, and I saw an advert of a Dutch firm, VR Wessen. They wanted somebody to promote carbide tooling on the continent, and the question must be able to speak English and German. And I applied for the job, and after a few weeks I got a letter. You're the only suitable person we have found. Will you please come to an interview to London? Gave me the hotel and that's like, and I went to the bank to get some money out, and I had no money. My wife had separated with forged signatures, and her boyfriend was a bit of a guitarist, and you know, then I of course was rather shocked and went to legal aid, and they suggested I should see a solicitor, and the solicitor says, well, as long as you live in that house, you're responsible for all debts you may incur. I said, well, how about putting an advert in the paper that I won't be? He says, there isn't standard in court. You will still be responsible while you're there. So I moved to Hatton here, and I was living in Lodzing here. And while I was at Priestman's, the lady that owned this house, her husband got killed in a car accident. She said, well, you can have that little room upstairs and do your watches, you know. So, because in Lodzing there was only a bed and that was it. And, well, anyhow, it developed, and after the required 10 years waiting time for a divorce, I married her.
When did you become an English subject, British subject?
I'll give you the date. I've got the paper here.
Well, approximately, anyway.
Well, 51, I think it was 51.
So you never had any intention of returning to Germany?
Not after I had been back for that month of holiday there. And besides, I got involved with this girl, married her, and I got in touch with my old firm, you know, which was working for Blumenfoss, and they said, well, we advise you to stay over there and learn English, and then we could use you later on in your capacity as an interpreter.
What do you feel now about having served in the Second World War?
I think this was the worst thing that could have happened. Those were the so-called best years of my life, which I spent as a soldier.
And you were telling me a story, if we can put it on the tape, about your interest in American or English pop music or jazz.
Oh, that was
how you got into trouble about
that. Was in the, it was before the war. I know I bought one English, the first ever English record I bought was a Donkey Serenade, which everybody in England will know. And I found that any sort of popular German dance music was obsolete within a very short time. So at that time it was required that you handed back a shellac record if you wanted to buy a new one. So quite a few records used to come into one of the shops where I was friendly with the daughter of the owner, and I used to sort out the English records and in exchange get other of those shellac plates. And that's where I got quite a collection together. And we called ourselves the International Hot and Swing Club. It was a group we used to meet in Hamburg. And of course, we couldn't have any sort of insignia. What we had was a common dress pin with a silk thread on it. And on the other end, we used to glue a gramophone needle, which we were hanging down from the lapel of our jacket. This was a sort of recognition sign, which hadn't got any sort of implication for anything else, you know. And we used to go outside Hamburg and meet on there was an island in the center of the thing, and we used to play our music there. And it was illegal to play English music by then. And anyhow, before that, before America joined the war, we used to go to the American embassy and listen to so-called jam sessions of music. And when the American consulate closed down, they rung a few friends and me up that we wanted some of those records. We were going to leave them. And I got about 30 or 40 of them. And at a later time, I was not really arrested, but at an inquisition, they came to see me and asked me how much information I had given them about the aircraft works, etc., in exchange for those records.
Given whom?
The Americans. You know, we used to go there for the music. And they were saying, you know, what have you given in exchange for those records? And
had you given any information?
No. There was no idea of doing anything like that. I mean, we were pleased to listen to the music, to see Gillespie, Jack Teagarden, and all that kind of stuff was in our line.